Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, normally the No Direction Network's Pathfinder News, Reviews, and Interviews podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Ryan Costello.
I'm Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Perrin.
This is a special edition of the podcast where we are putting away our Pathfinder toys and we are exploring another game company, one that should be familiar to our listeners and to people that play the game, we normally talk about, Pathfinder, and that would be Green Ronin. Now, Green Ronin is famous for some of its third-party products that came out for Pathfinder, but that is selling the company extremely short. And so we do want to spotlight some of the products that they put out that you might not be aware of, or if you're a regular listener of our podcast, you probably have heard about, at least in passing. Especially because a couple of members of the Green Ronin, or a couple of people that are influential in the Green Ronin design space, are members of the network. So we'll introduce both of them right now, starting first with our amazing game master for the Adventurous Actual Play podcast, Crystal Frazier.
Hi.
Hi, Crystal. It's good to have you.
Thank you. I always enjoy being on the show. And yeah, it's nice to be here and talk about what I do for my day job.
I was just talking about what I do for my day job. Also joining us, he is the main host, or the first chair on the No Direction Beyond Starfinder podcast. That is Mr. Owen Casey Stevens. Hi, Owen.
All right, how's it going?
It is really good. I am warm because I have a lot of layers on, but I wanted to dress fancy for the occasion.
I like the vest look. It's good.
I love vests. I always have.
If I'd known we were doing a vest night, I would have dressed appropriately.
So there was allusions to like an opera theme, and I was like, I'm going to dress fancy, and if I'm the only one dressed fancy, then I'm the fancy one on the podcast.
Yeah,
and I'm okay with that.
Except you're pretty much always
very uncomfortable right now. I am such a t-shirt guy.
Yeah. Turns out all my crinoline.
I saw buttons and I was confused.
And I bet as the night goes on, you're going to see unbuttoning. I've got my cool BB-8 as a snowman t-shirt on underneath, so it'll slowly be revealed. But finally, joining us is for the first time is someone who has done more than you might imagine for Green Ronin, Mr. Stephen Kenson.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
It is really good to have you. People talk very highly of you. We've maybe formally met in the past, but if so, I unfortunately forgot about it. So I am looking forward to really...
I made that up.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Maybe it's not on me.
Right? Yeah. Could be.
Yeah. But I have a feeling at the end of this episode, we are going to be fast friends.
Right. Plus, members of the network who listen to our seminar coverage probably have heard Steve on many of the Queers of Three-Sided Dice recordings that we air on the network.
Dungeon novices in chat, because we are recording this live in front of our Twitch audience, which, Param, you should tell people about as soon as I finish this anecdote about Dungeon Novice saying, wait, what's happening Tuesday? Karam, what is happening?
Right now we are doing a surprise live, a surprise to all of us, episode, a special episode, and we are streaming it live onto our Twitch channel, where you can chat with us and ask questions during the episode. If you wish to chat with us on any future episode and you're listening to the recording, you can do so at twitch.tv/nodirection. Throughout the episode, we'll be gathering up questions and comments from the chat and forwarding them to our guests.
Yeah, the first Green Ronin role-playing game that I heard about was the adaptation of Dragon Age. So as far as original Green Ronin role-playing games, and this led into the Fantasy Age role-playing game. Now, this is one that, you know, it's good that exists. It's good that there's a variety of fantasy role-playing games out there. But as a Pathfinder player, I already have my fantasy role-playing game. But I am curious, let's say, Owen, can you convince me that maybe I should have taken a closer look at Fantasy Age after all these years?
I mean, I'm the Fantasy Age developer at Green Ronin, so if I can't do it, I will probably get fired. So hopefully I can convince you you should take a closer look at it.
No problem.
Fantasy Age grew out of Dragon Age. It was also what was used for the Will Wheaton show, where they went over Titan's Grave, and there's an entire, therefore, video series of people playing this game. So if you want to watch people play a game and learn how it's played without having to bring people into your home, there's an entire season of a television show of people doing just that. So it has that as a buy-in. The thing that I like about Fantasy Age as a different experience than Pathfinder, because obviously I'm a big Pathfinder fan. I've played a lot of Pathfinder. I've helped design for Pathfinder. Fantasy Age just does not take as much brain space for me. I mean, the whole... I don't want to get into spine measuring here, but yeah... you know, even first edition Pathfinder is like this thick, second edition is this thick, Fantasy Age is like this thick. So it's it's faster. It's there's the spine comparison. It's faster to get into. It's easier, but because of the stunt system, it is not boring or predictable. It specifically has a system designed to make interesting, in my opinion, cinematic things happen in a non-predictable but regular and fun way. And that is what really causes me to be interested in Fantasy Age and have a good time with it. That you'll be going along and suddenly, a famous example from Nicole Lindrews, who signs my checks, right, at Green Ronin, is someone wanted to do a throwing axe trip. They wanted to throw their axe at someone's feet, trip them, and stunt dice came up with stunt points. So they were able to say, okay, that should be about this many stunt points. You can trip them. And it allows you to do that thing in too many role-playing games. The cool, unusual thing is either very, very, very difficult to actually pull off. So if you try it, it's a penalty. Or becomes the number one tactic because you've gotten so good at it that it's always a better choice than just stabbing or punching someone. And Fantasy Age splits that difference by causing it to happen regularly, but not always in your control. So the circumstances that bring up when can you do something cool vary, and then you pick from your little table of cool things you can do. So it's not entirely random, but it's also not always your call. And I personally always see that. Did the enemy happen to step someplace where he's vulnerable? When you're watching a movie, you see all these things, right? People trip over rocks or they get blood in their eyes. You don't want 8 million tables that determine whether or not someone is vulnerable to an attack. But you do want to have those random, interesting, non-planned out moments occur to keep the game fun. Mm-hmm.
Now, Owen, when you said that you might get fired if I don't say I'd been playing the game, I decided I was going to say one way or another that, wow, you really have convinced me. So believe me or not, wow, you really have convinced me. This actually does sound like a game that it would scratch a different itch, even if it is a similar setting to Pathfinder. And I can definitely see, especially in like a con setting, a reason to sit down and give Fantasy Age a try.
I found it. It's a lot like some people like to play the Pathfinder or Starfinder beginner box with friends because it's a quicker, faster setup. And they may or may not want to run a full campaign, although there are people that do full campaigns with just the beginner box. Mm-hmm. Even at Paizo, right? When I was working at Paizo, there were some of us that had a 5e game just because it was a somewhat different experience. Mm-hmm. So I like to role play a lot, and I like a lot of different role playing games to scratch different role-playing itches. And that's one of the things I really like about Fantasy Age is I can quickly, easily get new people into it, get characters made, and get to the fun stuff quickly.
I find that I like to play it when I am thinking about this would be a really fun campaign to play in E6. It's like it seems to fit that same niche in my playstyle.
Well, you know, I've got people who I play with on a regular basis who play Fantasy Age, and they go, oh, that's just not crunchy enough for me. But I've also had people that I will bring into a Pathfinder or Starfinder game, and they end up going, I can't keep track of all those modifiers. This feels more like doing my taxes than playing a game. So I think there are different sweet spots for different people and different levels of dedication, and I think that's great. I think the more different kinds of games we have, the more likely we are to find the right game for the right people so that they can get around and have fun with their friends, which for me is the important part.
Crystal, it felt like you were about to chime in about Fantasy Age.
I was just saying we will just have to run it for you at some point to give you a shakedown on the system. It's
someday
not like
there
we
will
don't
be cons
like,
again.
What, 7 variations of the age system between like Expanse and Modern Age and Blue Rose and Fantasy Age and Dragon Age and Threefold and I guess Threefold is a setting for Modern Age,
but yeah.
Yeah, so. Vermicling is in chat and said that they recently got into Modern Age and really dig the stunt point system. Modern Age feels like if I wanted to play, say, a G.I. Joe style role-playing game, that seems to be the way I'm going. Is that...
Yeah.
It's, G.I. Joe style role-playing game would be awesome in Modern Age. It would be so easy to do the kinds of specialized characters and having, you know, different weapon loadouts and the code names would work well. And it would be very, very easy to have the quick action where you're focusing on this is what this one group of characters is doing.
Can I just have a parrot as a talent?
Right?
I'm sorry, I talked over Steve. Steve?
Oh, I was just going to say that Crystal's work on adapting the Lazarus setting for Modern Age would actually be terrific for that kind of action adventure, sort of paramilitary stuff as far as that goes.
Vermiclin continues, they first checked out Modern Age because they were thinking of running a game based on the show Deadwood.
Yeah. I'm actually running a Victorian Monster Hunters game right now in Modern Age.
I was wondering how it would handle sarcastic. Modern
is pretty broadly applied.
It is.
Mm-hmm. It goes from like...
If you're from gunpowder being super common all the way up to near future, is pretty much Modern Age, right? Everything from gunslingers to cyborgs to G.I. Joe to spy work. I personally tend to use it for a lot of urban fantasy stuff, things inspired by maybe Dresden Files or there was Diana Tregard by Mercedes Lackey. Any of that magic plus people tromping around with baseball bats and revolvers oeuvre, to me, Modern Age handles very, very well.
Jeremy, you were saying?
He just confirmed it. I was wondering, can this handle my sarcastic urban fantasy teenager games?
Oh, yeah.
If we did a supplement called Sarcastic Urban Teenagers, that would be perfect for Modern Age. Yeah.
Param, I will buy that title from you.
Darth Krzysztof in chat is saying, knowing the rule set is half the battle.
Well, that's an easy battle for this one.
I think I'm pretty good on Age. I've got a pretty solid handling of it. It offers way more than I thought it did, and it's especially hearing about Modern Age, this is one that wasn't even on my list to talk about today, and that's suddenly the one I'm most interested in all of a sudden. And Crystal is making a face and reaching for something.
No, I was right. Just going to get Modern Age.
Yeah.
I should have it right here. Dragon Age, Blue Rose, Core Rulebook. I should have it right here.
But, working as we have been on different versions of the Age system, we have really found how... flexible it is for a lot of different things, because we've been applying it to lots of different genres, from fantasy to modern to science fiction with the Expanse.
Yeah, and you've got all three very different Age developers here on you, between Owen working on Fantasy Age, and I did our dystopian near future cyberpunk game, and Steve did everything. Steve put together the Blue Rose game, which is romantic fantasy, and also the Expanse RPG.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you did the Expanse RPG. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
So Expanse was basically both the opportunity to work with the Expanse setting, which is terrific in and of itself, and applying the Age system to a far future, fairly sort of hard sci-fi setting. And, it really adapts really well to it as far as that goes. And as we've done different variations on the Age system for different genres, we've sort of grown and expanded different ways to apply things like the stunts, the core stunt system. And we've come up with different types of stunts, concepts of having very sort of situational stunts, and things that are not related, attached to the characters, but are attached to the location they're fighting in. There might be special stunts that you can do because you're fighting on the edge of this precipice, or because you're fighting in this, dangerous factory over these, vats of boiling, molten metal, and so we find some interesting ways to extend the system that don't actually add a lot of complexity, but add a lot of variety so far as it goes. And it's been a really interesting sort of engine to play around with in that regard.
Actually, I kind of...
As far as customizing goes, my personal favorite customizing Age to work for something is that Steve came up with the churn mechanic for the Expanse, which the term will be familiar with fans of the Expanse. But Steve, do you want to talk about churn just briefly?
Sure. Basically, for folks who are not super familiar with the Expanse, particularly in the novels, there's basically a point in every Expanse novel where things go really bad. you think that the dramatic tension is building to a particular direction, and then all of a sudden things go like up to 11 and we're like, oh, that's bad.
Part of the planet blows up.
Right. Part of the planet blows up, you know, that kind of a thing. So we wanted to simulate that sort of tension in the context of the game and have the potential for that. So basically there's a counter or a pool that builds up over the course of gameplay. And it's triggered by certain things. And basically the better the characters are doing, generally speaking, the faster it builds up. you know, when things are going really well, that you're in trouble because because the churn is building faster and faster. And there are certain thresholds where you'll check to see if something bad happens, essentially. And it builds up to a maximum point where, you know, things like, oh, part of the planet just blew off. We may have a problem.
So the churn gives the GM a blue turtle shell.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah.
That's
pretty much.
That's really clever.
And it's very in keeping with the way those stories work. But again, it's something that is connected to other mechanics and it just happens. But the fact that you can have players going, oh no, I'm doing too well, it's very in keeping with the way the characters in the Expanse will say, this is all going way too smoothly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was wondering how it was going to simulate the fact that it's basically a chronicle of how badly one person's mistakes can screw up a galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
kind of.
So with all of the different incarnations of the age system, let's say I've played a couple of campaigns of like a urban modern ninja setting. And then for our third campaign, we want to go to feudal Japan. Could mm-hmm. we just then swap over to the fantasy age system and not have to modify our characters? How much modification would we have to do to adapt a modern character to a fantasy character?
For viewers of the direction, I think it's probably safest to say this is a lot like going from 3.5 to Pathfinder, right?
Okay, not Pathfinder to Starfinder.
There are similar mechanics, but it's not exactly the same. So, you know, for example, if you're playing a modern age character, you may well have like firearm skills that might or might not be relevant in feudal age Japan, depending on when you pick your feudal age Japan. But mm-hmm. the core idea of how the game works and most of the terminology goes over pretty smoothly. So yeah. It's a lot like saying, what am I going to do with all these ranks and use rope? It's not a big deal, but there is some translation from one system to another.
Yeah, they're similar enough that you can import monsters from one to the other with...
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, right. Like some very minor tweaks depending on how you run your modern game, but...
Yeah.
Aaron, what do you think?
Over pretty similarly.
I really... I have not got to play The Expanse, so I don't have much experience on that. But otherwise, I have really enjoyed how well the age system has really, like, when you were talking about the Expanse and Mercedes Lackey books, and you guys have a really good call out towards, especially in Blue Rose, when you talk about exactly what type of fantasy that you're going to be targeting with that. Mm-hmm. I find that this is a really great system when you're wanting to simulate a drama on a personal scale and not an epic scale.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we were going to save Blue Rose for last, but we've mentioned it a couple of times at this point. So I think Blue Rose is the one we should talk about next. And Steve, I'm told you're the one that I should ask, what's Blue Rose?
So Blue Rose is what we refer to as a romantic fantasy role-playing game and setting. It's a game using the age system similar to Fantasy Age, although it has its own customizations to suit the setting. And it has a setting based in the sort of subgenre of what we refer to as romantic fantasy in the context of the books. Which is basically fantasy settings where you'll commonly find that character relationships are extremely important, especially the notion of cooperation, particularly, and primarily the notion that the characters are good people who are looking to, you know, uphold a good standard or a good civilization or a good community. Community is very important in the setting, rather than people who are, you know, sort of wandering on the fringes of civilization, breaking into things and robbing them, so far as that goes. So it definitely aims for the feel of a lot of fantasy fiction like Mercedes Lackey's Valdemar or Tamora Pierce or the like. Particularly a lot of fantasy fiction where psychic abilities are also very prominent, which are an element of the setting. There's a very strong crossover between magic and psychic ability in the context of the setting.
Now, Crystal, the reason that Blue Rose is something that I'm suddenly much more aware of is because a couple of times you've mentioned our adventurous campaign, the War for the Crown from Paizo, be amazing as a Blue Rose adventure. So can you go into why you think that is?
Well, because the Pathfinder system is built at its core around that combat engine, which works great for combat, but can be a little rough for social. But Blue Rose is built from the ground up to be about socializing and adventure and investigations just as much as it is combat. It uses the same basic engine to resolve all those things. So Blue Rose is just kind of built for all of the talking and the scheming and the trying to make friends and like building up relationships and having those become something very important that you can draw on.
Yeah, relationships in Blue Rose actually have a mechanical value to them. You define the character's relationship in terms of what it is, you know, whether they are in love with someone or they're a rival with someone or they are, you know, boon friends or mentor and student or whatever the nature of their relationship is. And the relationship is also given an intensity, a mechanical rating in game terms. And relationships in the age system dovetail with the stunt system such that you can draw on your relationship for bonus stunt points, essentially, to do things that are motivated by your relationship. And in fact, it even gets to the point where there are special stunts that have a stunt value or cost that's higher than you can normally just randomly roll because they're relationship based. And they're only things you can do if you roll some stunt points and you use all your relationship points on this stunt. So it's the things like I am going to protect my true love stunt, you know, sort of a thing. In fact, I think we have one that's called As You Wish in Blue Rose.
Nice.
And, you know, and you can really pull off a lot because it's intended to work based on this is something that is clearly super important to my character. So this is going to be my character's big moment.
So something that's surprising me about how you're describing the game, it sounds like it's crunchier than the age system. Is that accurate?
It's the same system as the age system, okay. Basically. It has its own specific subsystems. In Blue Rose, it's primarily the Arcana system. There's a particular system of magic and psychic powers that is reflective of the setting. But the relationship system, the stunt system, and the like are all basically the same as you'll find in Fantasy Age or Modern Age. Occasionally, you'll find some specialized stunts that are setting or character specific, but otherwise it's basically the same.
Right. And the age system isn't a crunch free system. I don't know that there's much as crunchy as especially first edition Pathfinder, like maybe Champions, but it's definitely got some crunch in it. It's just not as crunchy as we're used to.
And the other thing I think that's very, very important to say about Blue Rose, that especially if you're trying to reach an audience, that it's crucial, is that in Blue Rose, your character can be a cat.
Yes. That's a big selling point for a lot of people. A telepathic cat, mind you.
Or a pretty, pretty horse, or...
the two big selling points...
That's a huge selling point.
Yeah. The two big selling points I have for pitching Blue Rose to people are you can play a sarcastic talking cat, or it's like D&D, but everybody plays the bard.
Pretty much. Yeah, Blue Rose has the setting has different sort of ancestries that are a little different from the typical sort of fantasy ancestries that you'll find in D&D like settings. Mm-hmm. One of them in Aldia, which is Blue Rose's world, are called the Raiden. And the Raiden are essentially intelligent, awakened animals who have psychic and magical powers. The most common ones are cats, wolves, horses, and bears. But there are all kinds of Raiden, and people love coming up with new ones, and we've seen all kinds of ideas for them.
Oh, I remember a player being utterly delighted playing a Rye crocodile.
Yep.
Yeah, once you open those doors, the floodgates are open, and I've seen Rye badgers and Rye yep. parakeets.
Yep. And raccoons and snakes and oh yeah.
Oh, come on, Rycoons.
Rycoons.
I do like Rye yeah, as the abbreviation for the enlightened animal. That's
yeah.
It's so smooth. So what was like, well, what was your personal
support, right?
No, go ahead, Owen.
I was just gonna say it's useful. It lets people know that we're talking about a yeah. sapient, sentient, telepathic version of this animal that is a player character and is a different yeah. ancestry.
Yeah, yeah. In the context of the setting, Rai literally just means thinking. Raiden literally means thinking creature, thinking animal. So it's just a suffix. It shows they're intelligent.
So are the humans just Rai humans?
Man.
Rai hominids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for the sake of simplicity, we still call the humans humans, but...
Are there elves?
There are not. Are a couple of other ancestries in the setting. The Vada are the descendants of an ancient arcane race that was called the Vadazin that died out. And the Vada are their part human descendants who are somewhat elf-like. In the sense that they're sort of willowy and fey, and either very pale skinned or very like dark skinned, like black or purple, you know, gray skinned, or basically albino, and have innate arcane talents. There are sea folk who are amphibious and natural swimmers, friends with the Rye dolphins and the like in the setting. The night people who are brutish, strong, physically very powerful, they were created by sorceress experimentation generations ago in the setting as essentially a slave race. And they were liberated when the sorcerer kings that created them were overthrown. And now they are in the process of integrating into the central civilization in the setting. But because of the nature of their origins, the night people are often discriminated against because some people feel that they're just innately unclean or unnatural because they were essentially created by sorcery.
Now, if I wanted to use
created by sorcery,
right?
It's usually the wizards that are experimenting. This time, it's the sorcerers.
And this is interesting.
So, if I wanted to use Blue Rose as the engine for, say, a G.I. Joe campaign,
oh my god!
I sense a theme.
If anyone has an honest answer for that, I'm curious.
Basically be G.I. Joe fanfic.
Right. Go on.
Like you'd focus a lot more on like Shipwreck's relationship with Snake Eyes than you would about like stopping Cobra, and it'd be about like Duke's like secret burning passions for Cobra Commander that they're like they're forbidden.
Yeah. The Baroness would get a lot more screen time.
Oh, yeah,
an archive of their own / Red, White, and Blue Rose.
Yes.
I mean,
there wasn't a hard drive that had a romance with
Mainframe had a romance with Serana. That's what you're getting at, Zartan sister. Great. Yes. That actually a plot line that carried over to multiple episodes.
We've already exceeded my knowledge of G.I. Joe. Now, if you want to talk about how to convert Ninja Turtles,
before I do anything with Ryan, just so that I can drop it in.
So right. you all also alluded to like sorcery doing very bad things. This is a theme in Blue Rose that magic isn't always the perfect answer to everything.
No, it's very true. In fact, sorcery has a very specific connotation in Blue Rose. Sorcery is essentially corrupt magic. Magic in Blue Rose is referred to as arcana. Essentially magic that controls, influences, or transforms people or living things without their consent is innately corrupt. And it has a sort of a feedback effect that corrupts the user when they do that. Unfortunately, there is a certain amount of inherent power in sorcery. In addition to the fact that you can obviously do terrible things, the power feeds on itself. And so the more sorcery you do, the more powerful a sorcerer you become, and the more tempted you are to use sorcery to fix your problems, essentially. Which, you know, sorcery is probably creating in the first place. And so there is definitely an inherent temptation to use arcane power for evil, essentially. And that makes that power that much more of a responsibility for the people who wield it. And it definitely is an underlying theme in the setting. For example, the aforementioned sorcerer kings who ruled most of the setting long ago were the ultimate example of terrible, corrupt, powerful sorcerers until they were overthrown. And now, in the modern world, there's definitely not a uniform opinion about how magic should be properly handled. Some places like Aldus, the Kingdom of the Blue Rose, the notion is that magic should be people with magical abilities should be taught responsibility, and they should learn what the risks are, and they should learn to use their abilities responsibly. In other parts of the world, the notion is that if you people have magical abilities, they need to be either very carefully controlled or they need to be simply wiped out because they're just too dangerous.
Interesting things I'm picking up is just the difference between how you spoke about the age system versus Blue Rose, where age system, it was pretty easy to sum up, and it was like, think of any kind of fantasy adventure or modern adventure, whereas Blue Rose has a lot of depth to it. There is a lot of just moving parts going on in the campaign setting. I really was not expecting to find out so much about what was going on in just the universe of Blue Rose.
I mean,
one of the interesting distinctions between the two is that Fantasy Age is really set up as a game that you can use as a toolkit.
Mm-hmm.
So more than once, there are things in the Fantasy Age basic rulebook that say, you can do things this way. Or if you want this different feel, you can do things this other way. Like there's a discussion when you get to the companion that we only have mages in Fantasy Age, right? There's no distinction between whether it's psychic magic or clerical magic or arcane magic. It's a mage, it's a spellcaster, you all get access to the same spell lists. But there are places we talk about, hey, if you really want a distinction between this is magic from ingesting the glowing rocks, and this is magic from being hit in the head with a meteor, and this is magic from praying to gods, you can make those distinctions, and here are some ways to go about it. Blue Rose, we very much wanted to take that toolkit approach, that system where we're saying, here are things you can do, and say, here's a very specific world, which we've already released once, which we have a very clear idea how we want it to work. Here is how the age system supports that specific setting and those specific themes. Mm-hmm. So there's a reason that Fantasy Age is named for the game system, right? Fantasy Age is pretty generic a name. Blue Rose is very, very specific and colorful because we are talking about one world and one way of doing things. That doesn't mean you can't borrow back and forth. If you want to take dwarves from Fantasy Age and put them in Blue Rose, that's actually super easy. You could also borrow some of the relationship concepts out of Blue Rose and adapt them easily to Fantasy Age or even a Modern Age. If you wanted to say, all right, I'm going to do a G.I. Joe game in Modern Age, but you know what? I'm going to take these relationships and I'm going to turn them into military ranks so that higher ranked people have these options they can use when duty is upon them and they have to do this thing for God and for country. You could do that. All of the tools are right there, but we've implemented them in a specific way for Blue Rose.
I've missed working with you, Owen.
Right?
One of the reasons I really like Blue Rose's approach to this is that, like, when I was, you know, a newbie fantasy fan, it wasn't the Howards and the Sword and Sorcery and the Conans and stuff that was drawing me in. I was obsessed with, like, Harper's Hall trilogy. And then as mm-hmm. I evolved, it was, like, you know, Spellfire and Soulfire, and then moving on to, and even today, it's like Mistborn is some of my favorite series. And that's just a fundamentally different assumption for what a fantasy book is, where the idea of like a dragon's treasure and getting more powerful weapons is not anywhere near as important as like powerful allies, cunning wit, and, you know, using your special gifts to their most efficiency. And it's like D&D and Pathfinder is like a really bad simulation if I'm trying to do that, because my characters are just going to naturally become so much more powerful than any of the threats I was worried about at level one. And I can't really have meaningful interactions with those threats. But with like a Blue Rose and a Fantasy Age system, I can have meaningful interactions with the same threats that are going to end my campaign that start my campaign.
Well, at Harper Hall in particular, right, Dragon Song and Dragon Dream Singer and Dragon Drums, and for that matter, the White Dragon. Mm-hmm. Those are by Anne McCaffrey, for those that aren't familiar with them. I also read these a lot growing up, in between Howard and Warcock. But those are also very much coming-of-age style stories, and therefore the building of relationships is an important part of those stories. Whereas if you're looking at fantasy like Elric, when we're talking about building relationships with Elric, we're talking about whether you're going to follow the Chaos Gods or the Law Gods, and whether or not you're calling upon the ancient, obscene sorcery of your bloodline. And you could do stuff like that with a Blue Rose or a Fantasy Age, but it's very impersonal. It's not about who do I like, what kind of person do I want to be. That's all done. It's about whether or not your soul-sucking sword is going to destroy the universe. So it's a different scale, but it's a different kind of story. And I think that's one of the reasons why things that do focus in general on the I am going to be a farm boy who ends up blowing up the Death Star and saving the universe and being the great hero. That journey is handled very well by classic D&D and Pathfinder, and we emulate it pretty strongly in Starfinder. Mm-hmm. Who am I going to be, and who are my friends, and am I going to find a place where I feel happy and I have a family of choice around me? That's a very common fantasy trope, but it's one that's handled by a very different set of mechanics. And that's one of the reasons why I think having these very different games so that you can scratch different itches, just like Ryan said. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important part of having a well-rounded option for gaming experiences. And I think different people enjoy popping back and forth, and some people enjoy one more than the other.
Mm-hmm. You filled my head with the idea of like a frustrated Blue Rose GM trying to get something out of the guy playing Luke Skywalker. And it's like, your aunt and uncle are dead. You see their flaming corpses. It's like, uh-huh.
Okay, how much
this is your only family. They raised you as their own. Uh-huh. So we're going on the space adventure now, right?
Right.
The guy playing Luke, I want to go to the Imperial Academy. No, no, no. That's not what this campaign is about. You don't want to go to the Imperial Academy. Down to the desert. And
then by the time they figure out Darth Vader's his father, that's when the GM and the player are on the same page.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there we have some relationship mechanics, right?
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just kind of hung up thinking about how great a Blue Rose conversion for Wizard of Oz would be, because those mm-hmm. are the fantasy books I grew up with.
Mm. Yeah.
This is my first time sitting here realizing, oh my god, that would be perfect.
Well, why don't you go into that?
I missed that completely. I went
to Wheelers would still be creepy.
Oh, yes. Yes.
In any game system.
Do you want to explore that idea, Crystal?
Oh, no, no. We've got tons to do. But maybe in a future Ronin podcast. Besides, I don't really have those ideas fleshed out at all.
Mm-hmm. Haven't had time to build this model to scale or paint it yet.
Right?
But right, we do have, you know, even more game systems we want to get to if we're going to keep talking about Green Ronin.
Right. Yeah, well, the big one that I want to talk about is Mutants and Masterminds. I just want to make sure, am I missing something big about Blue Rose? Some question that I should have asked now, something well, that I am not thinking about.
I will say the other thing about Blue Rose that is near and dear to my heart is that Blue Rose is also a very inclusive setting so far as that goes. One of the things that we baked into the setting from the beginning starting with its mythology and the whole sort of origin of the cosmology and the development of the setting itself, was the notion that there's a great deal of variety and inclusivity in expressions of gender and romance and relationships within the context of the setting as well. So one of the things I like a lot about Blue Rose is that there's a whole mythology that basically explains why people who are primarily in different gendered relationships are referred to as they're referred to as Sepia Luath, which means keepers of the flame, which relates to the hearth gods and the whole notion of family lineage and the like. And that people who are primarily in same gender relationships are referred to as Karya Donin, the lovers of the dawn, after the great love story of the god of the dawn and the like. But the interesting thing about it is that those are two ends of a spectrum, and pretty much everybody in the middle doesn't have a special name because it's just what everybody is. And pretty much everybody else in the Blue Rose setting is just assumed to be pansexual. It's just the people who are really only interested in like one particular gender who get a name.
Yeah, one of the things I really love in Blue Rose is, remember how fifth edition got so much credit when they had two paragraphs about picking your gender? Blue Rose has two pages.
Yeah,
we go on and on about marriage rights and gender and romance because it's romantic fantasy. It's a big deal, you know.
Also because it was written by a bunch of queers. And
right. Plus,
we're sappy.
Yeah.
Something very, very important and basic with game design and setting design, which I didn't even think of until I was working at the office at Wizards of the Coast back in 2000-2001, is what you reward and what you discuss, you will get more of. Yeah. So this in D&D, this is frequently what leads to the murder hobo trope. Oh, I am rewarded for killing things and taking their stuff. Therefore, obviously, what I want to do the most is wander around and kill things and take their stuff. And sometimes people will talk about, well, that doesn't mean you can't do these other things. No, it doesn't mean you can't do these other things. But it does mean you've not created an environment that specifically says, this is welcome, this is appropriate, this is what we expect. And so Blue Rose took some of those things that were not necessarily well supported in gaming and said, this acceptance, this pansexuality, this openness, this idea that these things are not only okay, but they are typical, is what we expect. It's what the setting is grounded in. And that speaks to people that may be telling you how easy it is to skewer another troll, have that same experience.
Speaking of speaking to people, Stephen, what is some of the feedback you've gotten for Blue Rose on specifically this emphasis on inclusivity and diversity?
Oh, it's been quite a range.
I was looking for a heartwarming story.
But there have been a lot of really wonderfully heartwarming stories. I have had folks come up to our booth at conventions just teary-eyed, to say, thank you, this game is wonderful. I've never seen myself represented in a game before. I've never seen a game where I can play a character like me. This is amazing. We had wonderful feedback as far as that goes.
The Blue Rose may be
something heartwarming, yes. But I also want to give credit to these two in particular. They get attacked for making this setting and for supporting it and talking about it. And I don't, because I'm not queer. So people just give me a pass and then focus venom and bile and hate on these lovely, brilliant creators. And I think it would be doing them a disservice not to point out that they knew this would be the case when they decided to create the setting and when they supported it and when they wrote for it and when they came on this show to talk about it. There will be people who will take time out of their day to write hate mail and possibly death threats to them, and in this case, not to me, for this setting. And It's an act of bravery, and it's an act of conscious effort on their part to say, we want our games to be accessible and to help create a world we want to live in. And I am constantly in awe of the bravery and endurance that they show in doing this. So I don't want that to go unnoted.
I mean, it meant a lot to me, especially as like a little baby gay going to Gen Con. And it was like going to some of the Queers Three-Sided Dice and seeing Steve there and seeing some of the booths and shirts that you all had. It was like, oh, there's place in this industry for me. So I kind of want to make a bit of a, it's one of the reasons that I've worked so hard to stay in it was just seeing the influence of people like Crystal and Steve and Liz and Wes and all of them, that there was a success and expressions of art that wasn't being super, 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 super repressed, only a little bit majorly repressed.
It's being attacked. That doesn't mean it's being suppressed, right? The mm-hmm. Green Ronin is very supportive of them mm-hmm. and these goals, and it's part of the culture of the company.
Yeah, Green Ronin
without a question.
Yeah. They've always been eager to do what's right, and when they fuck up, own it and try to push mm-hmm. forward.
Crystal.
Sorry.
Language.
Darn it.
And Crystal will now
understand where it came from.
Yeah, sorry, I screwed up. I will try to do better.
Okay.
All right, so that answered the Blue Rose question. Do you want to ask about another game system?
Actually, it kind of got garbled. Yeah, Crystal, can you talk about the t-shirt?
Oh, we just had Blue Rose Made Me Gay t-shirts and bookmarks for Gen Con for a couple of years, because that was the running joke in the fandom, because this is actually the second edition of Blue Rose. The first edition mm-hmm. came out 16 years ago?
Yeah, before, about 15 years ago.
Before it was really okay to be gay in this industry? Back when I was getting fired for being trans in this industry?
Mm-hmm. I remember I was doing background research for this episode, and I ran into an article called The Controversial Role-Playing Game Blue Rose, and I'm like, wait, did I make a horrible mistake inviting them on to talk about this? And I read the article, I'm like, what is they talking about? It's got mm-hmm. gay characters and trans characters yes, in it. It's not the, controversial.
It's the controversial notion that queer people are, in fact, people.
Oh. One of the impressive things that I feel about the legacy of Blue Rose is that it has helped normalize the idea that a game that includes these is not, in fact, controversial.
But there's all the Satan worshiping in there, too.
No, there isn't.
Talking cats.
Right.
Oh.
The talking cats may worship Satan. I know I am always very suspicious. Of
cats, nonsense. But... The talking cats only worship themselves. What are you talking about?
Sarcastic. Nobody's and worship themselves. Sign me up.
So everybody knows it's the corgis that worship Satan.
Right.
So speaking of trans gay characters, I believe there's quite a few on the cover of your book here, Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
Mutants and Mastermind?
There's only one who's canonically trans on that cover, but I just want to say that when I started in this industry as a little baby queer in 1990, the idea that I could put a transgender character front and center on a book cover was mm-hmm. just so out there. If I could go back 20 years and show this to baby Crystal, it would blow my mind. But for those who don't... those who don't know Mutants and Masterminds very well, first of all, it is a superhero role-playing game, and our Wonder Woman analog-style character, Lady Liberty, is transgender, which was one of my conditions for becoming the developer for Mutants and Masterminds, that I get to put a transgender character on the Freedom League, which is our front and center, like, big name superhero team like the Justice League or the Avengers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, one of my first tasks was make a beginner friendly book, because the third edition assumed a lot of mastery from second edition coming in and covers a lot of territory. But mm-hmm. if you're a brand new player, it could be a little dense, like coming in. So for a lot of our No Direction listeners who've never played Mutants and Masterminds, the Basic Heroes Handbook goes into how you make a superhero in the modern world and pick what their powers are and their motivations and how you hit the ground running and fight crime and try to make a better world. And I mean, if you've played Pathfinder, you're already familiar with the basics of the system. It's based loosely on the D20 system. It's drifted a lot in the last...
Yes.
Oh gosh, it's coming up on 20?
Almost 20 years now, yeah.
One of the primary branches of evolution from the original D20 system. So you'll recognize terms like skills and feats, and you understand you're rolling a D20 and adding a bonus and going for a target number. Mm-hmm. It is very, very evolved from the class level based, I'm going to be a fifth level dwarf fighter.
Yes,
and that makes sense to emulate a very different genre. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, Mutants and Masterminds and Pathfinder are very distant cousins.
I mean, when I was reading the third edition book of it, I had to go check the back and to just to see if the OGL was still even on it because it seemed so different.
I think, more out of a sense of tradition and loyalty than out of any necessity at this point.
Well, I mean, again, it would be hard to claim that this book is not something that is derived from second edition, which is derived from first, which is clearly derived from the SRD, the system resource document. So I being a very lawful aligned person, I feel putting the SRD on there is the right thing to do. But people need to understand that it's that SRD only covers those derived mechanics, and there's stuff in there you can't use without a license or a program. So
yeah.
But, you know, it's one of a suite of role-playing games that we can look to Steve Kenson for.
Oh my goodness, yes. Steve gave us, The Expanse and Blue Rose and, he didn't create Shadowrun, but he worked on it for a while. Silver Age Sentinels, which was my favorite superhero RPG before Mutants and Masterminds.
Mm-hmm,
and I guess this is just Say Nice Things About Steve Day.
Oh,
why do you got to be so great, Steve?
Make he makes it so easy to say nice things about him.
Mm-hmm.
I've not ever worked on a Mutants and Masterminds product. That's not quite true. I worked on one. I just never finished it. Didn't get published. As someone who has never worked on any published Mutants and Masterminds, Rogue Genius published this up. I do have to say that one of the things about the Beginning Heroes Handbook that I love is that I've seen people who get overwhelmed by the complexity of Pathfinder or even overwhelmed by having to make a fantasy age or even a basic D&D character look at the templates in there to make a character and have a interesting, vibrant, different from everyone else character, I kid you not, in 8 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
5, but less than 10. You sit down, and in the time it takes to read the rules for Monopoly, you can have a character ready to play for a much more interesting game. I think that is a real testament to how much work Chris and Steve did on the outline and development of this book. And I think it's one of the most important things that has come out from Mutants and Masterminds. And I'm so thrilled to see Crystal's work on it.
Right.
Yeah,
I used it this summer to run an entire campaign with a group of players who'd only ever played Pathfinder. And we had a great game, and they learned the system, and we're making like crazy characters using just that book. And I very much appreciated how well it took a rather daunting task I had in front of me of teaching Mutants and Masterminds to a group of people who some of them have only been role playing for like a year.
That's great.
So there's an interesting comment in chat that kind of I want to focus on. It's from Verberkling saying, standard M&M is a great system, and it's hard to teach new players. They were so excited when they heard about the basic handbook. So can we talk about the basic hero handbook? Is it like a beginner box style product that it's the same game but lighter? Like, what is that compared to the core rulebook?
Yeah, it's very much the same game but lighter. Mm-hmm. The Deluxe Heroes Handbook is everything that you need for making characters like very precisely and mechanically. Mutants and Masterminds is at its core a point buy system where you decide exactly like how smart I want to be, how strong I want to be, what powers I have and exactly what they do. And you buy all that with a budget of points. But if you're brand new to the system, that's a lot to take in and a lot of new rules to learn. So the Basic Heroes Handbook basically hides a lot of that math behind like, here, I want to make a Paragon character. So, you know, you're flying, super strength, speed, super tough guy. And it goes through and asks you, like, what's more important to you, being observant, being steady, or being inspiring? And that determines what your spread of ability scores is. And then for skills, you get, like, some basic stuff just because you're that concept of a superhero. But then it asks you to pick, like, two areas that you've studied. Are you athletic? Do you command people? Do you know how to handle yourself at a crisis? Are you a scholar? And you just go through these, like, five different sections and make a choice or two in each one, and that puts together all the stats you need, mm-hmm. including what your powers are and what feats you get. And then you've got a hero ready to play out of the box, and you can learn the combat rules, the skill, or the social rules, all of that. And once you've got a stronger handle on the system, you can go back to the Deluxe Heroes Handbook and start playing around with the fine-tuning mechanics under the hood, which,
It's important to note, you can. You don't have to.
Yeah.
Correct.
If everyone else wants to make a very specific full Deluxe Heroes Handbook character and you like what you got out of your basic Heroes Handbook, your character is not underpowered or using a different rule set or having important information. You can pick that character up and drop them in a full M&M game. No problem.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the very best books ever in that regard.
The Basic Heroes Handbook is like configuring an app where you scroll through a few screens and you pick a few things from menus. Mm-hmm. And the Deluxe Heroes Handbook is like writing an app. If you're a programmer and you want to customize and you want to get into the code of how characters are built from the ground up, The Deluxe book will tell you basically how everything works behind the scenes, nuts and bolts. You can go back in and rewire things, change however you want. But if you're not interested in that level of mechanics, don't need it.
Yeah, In fact, I did it the other way around, where one of my players was making a time control based character that wanted to have a time blast power where they could shoot mm-hmm. bubbles that would slow people down temporarily. And like, we couldn't quite get it all mapped out in the Basic Heroes Handbook. So as the GM, I had the Deluxe and I knew the third edition a little bit better. So I was able to yank out the Deluxe one and says, well, here, let me break that down a bit into what it actually is under the hood. And then we'll tweak this. And here, your character mm-hmm. has this special adjusted power that's not in the basic book, but it still works with everything else that's in the basic book, and we can move on from there without having to overload that player with like tons and tons and tons of optional rules.
Right. I'm so glad that worked out.
Mm-hmm. So if a player comes to the table with a basic handbook and somebody else comes with the Deluxe handbook, they're sitting at the same table, they're playing the same game.
Absolutely.
100%
Yeah, it's like the basic kind of like is like pre-packaged builds and sub-builds that makes mm-hmm. it easy to put a character together that works and is statistically correct without like in Mutants and Masterminds, you can like, I have an ice beam that has this like special armor penetrating damage, but I want to simulate how it slows them down and maybe it causes like a numbing sensation, and you build all that out in the power when you buy it, and it's really cool. But sometimes you just want, well, I just want to hit them with the magic thingy, right?
I just want to zap them with lightning. Oh,
okay.
But yeah, it's kind of like, you like driving your car, so you can really like driving your car and enjoy that, or you can enjoy driving your car and also be the kind of person who likes to get under the hood and like fine-tune it and tweak it and swap it out with custom parts.
Mm-hmm. Now, what if somebody comes to the table and they're like, I want to be the son of a god and I control lightning and stuff, and another guy comes to the table and is like, I shoot arrows. How is balance? How is
the play
experience? That's actually, the Hawkeye problem. Those examples are in the Basic Heroes Handbook.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You got the crime fighter, and you just pick the archer special powers suite. And then we've got the paragon, and you pick the strange visitor suite. Or sorry, the champion suite.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, I'm sorry. One of the advantages of Mutants and Masterminds is like, especially if you're really getting into running it, is like you go for all of the superhero tropes, in which those different characters are very meaningfully useful. Like, not mm-hmm. especially like the god with lightning is not going to come in handy when I need somebody to super stealthily infiltrate the the high tech military base to extract our hostage or something. It's like it's definitely, it's like the prime example of you need to throw a varying array of challenges at your super team so that each of them has their spotlight time.
I mean, when Green Ronin was publishing the DC Adventures game, when we were basically licensing the DC universe and combining that with the Mutants and Masterminds game engine, we were statting out, you know, hundreds of established comic book characters. And it's interesting to note that both in the Mutants and Masterminds system, both Superman and Batman are roughly the same number of points as characters. So far as that goes, they just have two completely different areas of focus. You know, Superman is a straight up power character. He's got a lot of damage. He's got a lot of invulnerability. He's got a lot of fast movement and all of that. But Batman has a massive list of skills and resources, and he's incredibly good at everything, essentially.
You know, just throw sidekicks at every problem.
Until he runs out of them.
Well, there's always another orphan kid that looks just like a younger version of him.
Yeah. Hi. Weird. Bruce Wayne. I need another gross of orphans.
Those child labor laws in Gotham are pretty loose.
It's not labor, right?
But you know, that's how the system works as far as that goes. So I mean, a lot of the so-called human, you know, superhero characters, you know, have just a lot of other abilities that aren't just straight up, I can pick up a tank, but are still super useful. Like Parham says, it depends on the situation. When you want to sneak around or you need to investigate something, then that's when you want the characters who are good at that.
Yeah, you're all spending the same budget of points, so you decide what you want your character to be good at and invest in that. Mm-hmm. You can't be good at everything, even if you're Batman.
In fact, in our recent Super Team Handbook, we talk very explicitly about that notion about how in a team of superheroes, everybody has their particular roles mm-hmm. on the team. You know, they're the heavy hitters, but there are also the stealth characters, the investigators, the techies, the problem solvers, you know, all of that.
Yeah, and the system at its core is kind of built around what we call power level, mm-hmm. which is a measure of a lot of different things, but it's tends to be a balance of accuracy versus effect. Mm-hmm. So, for example, your power level to have the same power level as everyone else on your team, your attack bonus and your damage that you inflict average out to the same level. So you can have somebody who hits really hard but doesn't have a great attack bonus, or you can have somebody who is very accurate and always hits their shot but doesn't do a ton of damage.
Right. So you have the range from Hulk to Hawkeye.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm. And also, it's amazing how much that my players suddenly gained a whole lot of respect for the danger that the common street bandit type character is when one of them picked up an armor-piercing missile launcher.
I mean, mm-hmm. everybody's afraid of the guy with the missile launcher.
You can be the Man of Steel. There's a lot of things that can hurt steel.
Mm-hmm. Salt water.
Really? Huh. I'd like to see that supervillain.
Dr. Bride!
In a very basic fantasy game, you tend to see there's a problem, go to try and solve the problem, someone tries to stop you, and you stab them. So the ability to stab or do some variant of stab solves most of your problems. In a superhero setting, if the important gemstone that was going to be sold off to raise money to save the orphanage goes missing, you can't just wander around and keep stabbing people until the gemstone shows up, right? And that,
if you're the Punisher, that is in fact your tactic, but...
No, I think Rorschach actually is literally your tactic. Right. Walk into a room and start breaking fingers until someone tells you what you want to know. But that is why... it can be important to have characters who are good at different things, because until you get to the point where there's someone you can punch, you need to know what's going on and solve questions and answer problems, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera.
And yeah. Even once you get to the person you can punch, it's they're supervillains. It might be somebody so fast your strong guy cannot hit them. It might be somebody so tough that your archer's arrows are useless. It might be a ghost based on a 1940s Scream Queen who can summon movie monsters to make your life heck.
Yes!
Little Mutants and Masterminds.
That's awesome.
By the way.
She's a Mutants and Masterminds villain. Her name
Forget
is Scream
Dr.
Queen.
Brine. I love Scream Queen. Say that to Dr. Brine. They can both exist.
Right.
My favorite adventure I've ever written for Mutants and Masterminds is just called Monster Mashup. And it's Scream Queen, who's the ghost of a horror actress, teamed up with Madame Macabre, who is a horror show hostess who got actual magical powers by selling her soul.
Basically made a deal with the devil. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like this.
And they're the best duo ever. It's right. In my heart, they are our Harley and Ivy.
Harley Quinn show is so good. Just going to throw that out there.
Haven't seen it.
Oh, Crystal.
We don't have any of the fancy add-ons for streaming.
That's fair. That's a perk of my work. Darth Crystal in chat is saying that he wants to super beat him up and take his super stuff. And this kind of goes into what you've been saying, that, you know, you've got different skills, so you can handle different missions. Mm-hmm. But, you know, splitting the party is traditionally what you're not supposed to do. So what is a session or an adventure of Mutants and Masterminds look like?
Oh, gosh. It varies a lot depending on your players and what their builds are. So, mm-hmm. like, you can have a very traditional, not quite fantasy adventure, but a fairly traditional, like, modern RPG adventure of where you get some kind of mission, like this fabulous gemstone is stolen and we need that to fund the orphanage, which fuel our sidekick academy. So you go out and you investigate the crime scene and you, like, go to the bars where criminals hang out and ask around if anybody's seen a giant ruby the size of a fist, and probably have some kind of slugfest with a bunch of goons in a bar, and they point you to, let's say, a cybernetic T-Rex from an alternate universe who's going to use the ruby to power his dinosaur time portal.
Also an actual Mutants and Masterminds villain.
So then you've got to go and, you know, beat up Cerberus Rex, who's using this to create an interdimensional portal, and he's probably using the portal to pull, like, more killer dinosaurs out to throw at you during the fight. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you have, like, a psychic in your group, then you might just have somebody who can, like, track down the gem itself, and you get there before he's opened this portal, and maybe the fight opens a dimensional rift and you're all plunged into the dimension of dinosaur zombies, and it becomes a dinosaur zombie apocalypse.
One mechanical thing for Mutants and Masterminds that sort of demonstrates how adventures are intended to work is the hero points system. There's this resource called Hero Points that the players can use to influence the game in various ways, from simply just, like, re-rolling a die roll to get a better result, to, you know, just sort of shaking off damage conditions or doing special stunts, or things like that.
Oh, my favorite is using them to rewrite a scene.
Yes, so using them to sort of retcon, edit the scene.
Yeah, so if you, need to get into this lab, but there's a security guard out front, you can spend a hero point to be like, I went to high school with this guy.
We had a lot of fun in the time travel source book talking about ways to spend hero points to retcon things. Bill and Ted style, like, you know, remember the garbage can, like, sort of retcons. Basically, the characters start out with just one hero point to start with, and they build up hero points over the course of play in primarily two ways. One, by, like, being heroic and, you know, doing heroic things, which obviously encourages the players to be heroic. Mm-hmm. Having complications occur for the characters in the story, which are all of the classic, like, soap opera hero tropes of, you know, oh, I have a date tonight, but at the same time, you know, that, you know, I have to be, you know, here to, you know, prevent this crime. How am I going to slip away, you know, in time without revealing my secret identity, or, you know, any of that sort of stuff? You know, if the hero's weakness comes into play, or their arch enemy, you know, has got a plot against them, those kinds of things rack up hero points. So it basically simulates the comic book story arc of heroes encounter a problem, get trounced by it because they don't have any hero points to spend yet, go through the process of investigating, overcoming various obstacles and dealing with all of their various subplots, get to the end scene of the story where they have a nice pile of hero points built up, and suddenly they are much more capable, and they can take care of the villains with some teamwork and a few clever stunts.
And one of the things I've noticed in playing the Instant Masterminds, because I've actually played it a whole lot more than I've run it, is that the fact that there are hero points on the table and complications and story elements can affect everyone means that I am involved and interested in scenes where my character is stepping back. So even if Wombat Man is currently doing all the investigator stuff and I am playing Super Dude and can basically just hover around and be muscle, I am paying attention to what's going on because I never know when things are going to come up, or if I want to make a suggestion about how to edit a scene, or if I am going to be the focus of the GM deciding that suddenly someone thinks that they recognize me and I've got to conceal myself because my secret identity is at risk. Those story elements occur regardless of what my character's area of focus is. So it keeps mm-hmm. all the players involved in the story as it goes forward.
Yeah. Complications are basically mm-hmm. a free license for the GM to mess with the heroes in ways that reward the player.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Plus, I also like how the simplicity of not the simplicity of the system, because it's not a simple system, but the resolution mechanic where it's always a d20 mm-hmm. versus a number. It's a DC check every single thing you do in the game. How quickly that can be resolved, where it really has encouraged and allowed me to have scenes where the party is very much split up. I had a scene where the strong man was like wrestling the prison train down while the magic person was like fighting the attack helicopters above it, and the stealth agile people jumped inside to fight the security guards, and then all of a mm-hmm. sudden they all had to deal with when the train turned into Voltron robot, and that was and the shrinky character went inside the robot to trash it from the inside out, and all of that, none of the characters were really in the same place at any one time, but they were all affecting everything at the same time. I was switching between scenes like every other minute, and everybody was super invested the entire time. It's unlike in some games like Pathfinder, which I love Pathfinder, but when you split the party, that has a lot of complications on the system, whereas in this game splitting the party is usually sometimes the best way to get it done.
Mm-hmm. And that's another comic book trope that's mm-hmm. pretty common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Mutants Masterminds isn't a very lethal game, so there's not as much consequence to defeat. Like mm-hmm. it's built into the game that every now and then you'll get your butts kicked, like Steve was talking about, because you don't have the resources or you split the party. But generally what happens is you lose some small objective and you have to shake it off, and you've got a bruise for a couple of scenes.
Yeah, I played a Heroes Unlimited game where it took us like 2 sessions of character creation, and then a character died in the first fight. And I think that was the only Heroes Unlimited game we played.
I cannot comment because I played a lot of Heroes Unlimited in high school.
I admire your endurance for the amount of Palladium you've played, Crystal.
Played, run, written.
Crystal ran Ninja Turtles and Other Weirdness game for myself and some of the younger designers at Paizo, just so they would understand the primordial ooze from which modern game design has arisen.
This is the game we had, and we liked it.
We used to roll a d20 uphill both ways.
Right.
Do you remember someone discovering that their mutant turkey character had a fly speed around 120 miles an hour because that was the slowest fly speed?
Yeah, the mutant turkey who could fly like a bullet. Even though turkeys can't fly.
Can't fly. I swear to God. God is my witness, I thought they could.
I
All right. We are going to wrap up soon. We do have a question from chat that I want to get to, and I'll just ask anyone else in chat if you have any final questions about any of the games we've talked about, let us know. You've got a couple of minutes to get them in. Dungeon Novice says, how does writing adventures work when there are basically infinite abilities that you have to deal with?
I mean, it is complicated. We tend to break it down into scenes where we explain, like, all right, in this scene, these things are happen. This is the villain's agenda. This is, like, who the bystanders are. This is the setting of it. So you can't quite stat it out room by room like you can with a Pathfinder or a Dungeons & Dragons adventure. You kind of have to give the GM, like, all of the background director elements and just trust them to run with it and adapt it as they see fit. One of the things I've been doing with our adventure series is a sidebar, just calling out, hey, if one of your players has one of these powers, it may create complications in this adventure. Mm-hmm. Here's how you can deal with it, or you cannot, because they invested points to be able to do this thing, so it's cool for them to just do it sometimes. Like
Aquaman's got an aqua sometimes.
Right? Or like one of the complaints I see a lot with superheroes in general is, well, how do I run a mystery when one of my characters is a telepath? Like, well, for starters, they invested a lot of points in mind reading, so let them read people's minds. Like, mm-hmm. let them do Q&A things where your NPC can't lie but can still try to mislead them or misdirect them or just might not know everything that's going on. So, yeah, absolutely let your players use their powers. But to get back around to the point of how to do adventure design, a lot of it is, like I said, explaining who the characters are and what they want and where they are, and mm-hmm. then kind of throwing all your action figures at a fan.
Yeah.
Vermicling wants to know why the Expanse and Modern Age have different systems for damage, health points versus conditions.
So when we were working on Expanse, Modern Age basically has a number of different modes to it, because Modern Age, like Fantasy Age, is basically a generic system that's designed for you to do lots of different settings. So Modern Age includes a lot of different sort of modes or settings, from really gritty to really highly cinematic, as far as that goes. So you can adjust to your taste for the kind of game you want to run. Mm-hmm. The Expanse, because the Expanse is a very specific kind of setting that we were looking to simulate, one of the important elements was the fact that damage is a big deal, you know, in the Expanse. But at the same time, we didn't want damage to be such a big deal that it completely paralyzed the players. You know, if you make it to the point where they feel like if their character gets a scratch, they're out of the game, then the game really becomes no fun. So you want damage to be significant, yet at the same time, you don't want it to be so significant that it's ruining the game. And so the hybrid we came up with was essentially the fortune system, which basically replaces the character's health score with essentially a rating that says this is how important you are to the story. You know, and it's not that you're soaking up damage. It's that you're, you know, evading, you know, like, ooh, that was a close one, sort of a thing, where in fact you have taken damage, but it just means that, you know, that it's whittling away at your luck. And eventually that's going to run out. And, you know, there will be that proverbial bullet with your name on it. And then that's going to be a problem. And we had added a little extra complication to that by giving the players the temptation of spending their own fortune points to make their characters be able to do cool things, so that, you know, they were faced with the, oh, like, I could spend some fortune to, like, succeed at this, but if we get in a fight, I don't want to be down, like, 10 fortune points, you know. And so that provided a little tension and some trade-off as far as that goes. And conditions basically just sort of round that out, so that you have actual, you know, things like when the character is, like, actually wounded, and, you know, they're dragging around on a broken limb, or the like, then, you know, that's something that's has some significant game impact and some real mechanical effects on how long it takes them to recover as far as that goes.
So we have one last question and then we'll wrap things up. It's Darth Christoph wants to know, what are some of the other gems in the Mutants and Masterminds Earth Prime setting?
Oh, my. Oh, there's
everyone
so
gets
much.
One. What's your favorite?
Right?
Oh, just one.
Everyone gets 1 to 3.
I will offer up Hero High.
Yeah, Hero High is good.
So this is personally one of my favorite books. It talks about basically playing Teen Titans, Avengers Academy, X-Men, all that sort of thing. So lower powered heroes with higher expectations and way higher drama. And the superhero school that we have in universe is the Claremont Academy.
Claremont Academy.
Very nice.
The longest running M&M campaign I ever played in was a Hero High game where I played sentient algae.
You've told me about this character a couple of times, but every time you pitch it like that, it gets a laugh out of me.
Right. It just gets better. you know, yeah, I mean, I'm a colossal comic book nerd. So,
what?
Earth, yeah, I know, right? Shocking. Earth Prime is loaded with comic book Easter eggs of all kinds. I think at least for Freedom City, I once wrote out a complete list somewhere. I may even still have it. That, you know, is just like, you know, the names of things and, you know, like everything is an obscure comic book reference, basically. So
Ditko Street.
Mm-hmm. Ditko Street, for example. Nice. Yeah. It's where the Master Mages domicile is.
Have any of these comic creators that you're throwing in as Easter eggs ever caught on and reached out to you?
No, I'm sure most of them don't even know that role-playing games exist. But
if any of you are watching and you're looking for something to license, reach out to Green Ronin.
We're lovable.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, Chris Claremont's in chat and he has the following to say.
Oh. You never know.
It's possible.
Videos forever, right?
Right?
Nah. I mean, Chris Claremont seems cool. He gave us Kitty Pride and Ilyana Rasputin as girlfriends.
Right?
Or at least as much of it as he was allowed to by editorial, but he has since come forward and said, like, yes, obviously I wrote them that way. I just wasn't allowed to say it.
Yes.
I think we're ready to wrap things up. Param, is this was your idea. Is this the episode you envisioned?
It is everything I wanted it to be.
Excellent.
Glad to hear it.
So on top of... Go ahead, Owen.
Also does work and will soon be releasing Sword Chronicles. So there are yet more RPG systems, which we're not going to take any time to talk about. But feel free to go to the Green Ronin website and look at all the other lovely things you can buy from us.
We completely forgot to plug the Orc role-playing game.
Just all right.
Wait, what?
We're not joking.
No, we're not. Yes. Seriously.
It's a ton of fun. It's a light, easy system. It's about being orcs and smashing stuff.
Yes. All of your roles are opposed roles against the god of the orcs who hates you.
Oh, it sounds good. But
what is it called? What is the name of the orc role-playing game?
It's appropriately enough called Orc! The role-playing game.
It's not listed on the website.
What?
Not in the product section.
You got
I didn't
with
search. I clicked on the products.
Yes.
Wait, wasn't there an RPG Net Chronicles of this game being written?
Wouldn't be at all surprised.
All right. I have found it, but it's not in the drop menu. I'm just
well, we will take that up with our webmaster.
Seriously.
100%.
Because this looks super fun. Mm-hmm. There's a fire breathing. It looks more like a dinosaur than a dragon on the cover, which makes it more awesome. So on top of putting a spotlight on a lot of cool products and giving you all a chance to share things, we've just been talking about doing one shots and short run actual plays of most of these games, and so this was kind of also a primer for all of those things. I know Param and I have discussed playing a Blue Rose game where I play his adventurous character Glanville and he will try to play Xavier, my adventurous character. So that alone I'm very much looking forward to.
I don't know if I want to. if I want to run that adventure, if I want to be a background character in that adventure.
You want to run that adventure, don't you, Crystal?
Yes, but I've also got a great Blue Rose character who's a psychic goth.
Okay. Well, so these are things that over the next 6 months, I'm say at least one of them is going to roll out in 2020. You're going to start hearing more about. So I wanted people to get an idea of that. We are really going to start dipping our toes into more Green Ronin product, into the Green Ronin pool. And Param, I know you've been pretty excited about running Mutants and Masterminds for a while now. So yeah, now I've got a lot of characters to start thinking up and a lot of campaigns to, or at least adventures to start planning out. So yeah, thank you all. Everyone give an idea of where people can find you personally, and then one last shout out to Green Ronin. So let's start with you, Steve.
Folks can find me on the internets at stevekenson.com. I'm on Twitter at skenson, K-E-N-S-O-N. I'm pretty much most active on Twitter and my occasional blog. That's primarily the places to look for me.
Owen.
I've got a blog at owenkcstevens.com. It is supported by the lovely patrons of my Patreon, which is patreon.com/owenkcstevens. You can find me on Twitter on #Owen_Stevens. And I am on Facebook as owenk.c.stevens. So there's a theme.
And Crystal.
Unlike these lovely and competent gentlemen, I do not have a website. I had one, but I am a bad webmaster and it does not exist anymore. Anyway, you can find me on Twitter. I am at Amazon Chic, A-M-A-Z-O-N, and then Chic, C-H-I-Q-U-E.
Chic. And sorry, Steve, did you also throw the Green Ronin link up there?
Green Ronin is just greenronin.com.
And any social media that you think people should pay attention to?
You can also check out, it's at Green Ronin Pub for publishing on Twitter. That's our Twitter feed for all of our announcements and things that are going on. And we do have a company page on Facebook.
Yep, and we do live streams on Mondays and Fridays.
Mm-hmm.
Param? Where can people find out more about us?
You can find more of fantastic Pathfinder, Starfinder, in general nerdity, and also some awesome sad Green Ronin references at nodirectionpodcast.com, where you can also find the Discord link, which is home to the chillest role-playing community there is out there. If you want to hang out with our fan base and chat with many of the No Direction staff and guest cast, you can do so there by clicking on the purple Discord link there. And right under that purple Discord link, you're going to see an orange button. That's our Patreon. This content, the other content that we've expanded to, and future one-shots are only possible thanks to the generous support of our patrons. We very much appreciate everything you're able to do to help keep this network on the air. And if you want to become one of our patrons, you can do so by clicking on that link or going to patreon.com/nodirection. You can also find us at youtube.com/nodirectionshow, facebook.com/nodirection, and twitter.com/nodirection.
So thank you once again to our three guests for joining us. Thank you for the live audience we did not expect to have, but you were hopping tonight. You really added to the entertainment value and you informed the conversation with some great questions. Until next time, I'm Ryan Costello.
I'm Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param.
I guess I could say, if you want to find the path, you need no direction, but I feel like I should have come up with a Green Ronin-specific one. So I have failed you.
That's all right.
Seppuku for you.
We didn't get the host we needed. We got the host we deserved.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.